CD. Okay, the book of Joshua. Looking at your notes that are on the table there in front of you tonight, Joshua is the first of the 12 historical books. The historical books of the Old Testament follow the Pentateuch. Not that the Pentateuch isn't historical, but they're in a category all by themselves. And so there is another category of books of the historical books, and it is Joshua through Esther. And these 12 books cover 1,000 years. I didn't realize that until I was doing the research on this. Never gave that a thought. What a long period of time that these historical books cover. So it's from Joshua entering into the land of Canaan to the return from exile, which is another entrance into Canaan of the Jewish people much later in their history. You'll notice on top of your notes kind of a summary of the book. Through three military campaigns involving more than 30 enemy armies, the people of Israel learn a crucial lesson under Joshua. Victory comes through faith in God and obedience to his word, rather than military might or numerical superiority. And what a great lesson that is. And certainly has ramifications for every generation, not just the generation of Joshua. The name of the book is pretty obvious in this case, unlike Leviticus and Deuteronomy, books like that. The name is very obvious, and that is, it is named for its central character. Joshua was nearing 90 years old when he replaced Moses as the leader of the Israelis as they are on their way to Canaan. He later will die at the age of 110. So the book covers the last 20 years of his life. Now Joshua, at his birth, was given the name Hoshea by his parents. And that name means simply salvation. Moses, according to Numbers chapter 13, verse 16, later changed his name and changed his name to Joshua. Now, Joshua takes the name salvation, but adds God's name to it. So it's the idea Yahweh saves, or it could also be translated Yahweh is salvation. Now this in the Old Testament is the equivalent to the name Jesus in the New Testament, because Joshua is from the Hebrew and Jesus is from the Greek, but it is the exact same name. So it's very, very interesting that here is a person in the Old Testament with this name that refers to salvation. And here comes the Messiah, and he is given the earthly name of Joshua, that he too is a savior and delivering his people, this time from the bondage of sin. So it's a very significant name. Hebrews 4:8, for instance, builds on that name Joshua in the Old Testament and says, "For if Joshua had given them rest," that's the Jewish people, "had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on with another Joshua." And that second Joshua is the Lord Jesus Christ. By the way, of course, Joshua is one of the two spies who were sent into the promised land to spy out the land, come back and tell the Jewish people what to expect when they came into the land. Only two of the 12 spies came back saying, yes, they're a formidable enemy, but God can bring the victory. The rest of the 10 spies, the rest of the spies, 10 in number, said, no, we can't do it, and so on and so on. And as a result of that, those 10 spies and the rest of the generation of the Jewish people were under the judgment of God to wander around in the wilderness until they all died off. But Joshua is one who didn't, the other is Caleb. And Joshua, that means Joshua was born in Egypt. And he's one of only two who entered into the Promised Land who were of adult age at the time of the Exodus, who entered into the Promised Land. So think about that. Joshua was born in slavery. But not only that, we know from the genealogy, by the way, who's Joshua's father?
None.
He's the only person in the Bible with no father, right? Because he's the son of... No. It's N-U-N, not N-O-N-E. His father was named Nun. We know from a genealogy that's given that Joshua was the oldest son of Nun. So that means Joshua would have died in Egypt in the plague against the firstborn, except for the blood of the lamb that was put over the doorpost. And Joshua is one of those whose life was spared and at the first Passover. And all of that has a great significance concerning Christ. Well, who is the author of the book? Naturally, I think the first thought that everyone has to the answer to that question is Joshua. But it might surprise you to find out that the author is not specifically mentioned in the book. However, the Jewish Talmud ascribes the book, with the exception of the account of his death, like Moses wrote Deuteronomy, even though at the end of the book is the account of his death. That was probably written by Joshua or some one of his aides. Same kind of thing with this book. If Joshua was the author, that last part would have been, of course, written by someone else. So anyway, the Jewish Talmud, Jewish tradition, Scripture doesn't say it, but Jewish tradition is very strong that Joshua wrote the book, and it could very, very well be. We know from Joshua chapter 8, verse 32, and Joshua chapter 24, verse 26, that the book depicts Joshua as writing, although it does not specifically say he wrote this book, but he is depicted as writing. And we know that the book was written fairly soon after the events of the book had been done, because Rahab was still living. And, of course, she's one of the characters in the book, and we'll meet her. That's mentioned in chapter 6, verse 25, that she was still living when the book was written. The theme of the book is Israel possessing its possessions. So Israel is an inheritor of the promised land, the land of Canaan. It's theirs. God has promised it to them, promised it to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and then passed down from generation to generation. It's theirs, but they don't possess it. So the theme is that Israel now enters into possessing what it already possesses. There is an application of that to the Christian life, in that when we become a Christian, we then, according to Ephesians chapter 1, are blessed with all blessings in the heavenly places. But one of the things that happens in our spiritual growth is we begin to possess our possessions. You could think of it this way. There's a story told of a man who, back in the days when ships, traveling by ship was the only way to get from America to Europe, had booked a ship going to Europe. And he was poor, he didn't have a whole lot of money, and he spent all of his money on the ticket, and he bought the lowest class ticket. And so he brought with him a basket of bread and cheese and things like that. And the call would go out for meals, and everyone else would go to the dining room for meals, but he went to his cabin and had his bread and cheese and whatever. Finally, the last day said, "Why don't you go to the dining room?" And he said, "Well, I spent all my money on the ticket. I can't afford the meals." They said, "No, it's included with your ticket." Can you imagine how he felt at the end of the trip learning that? And there is a sense in which many Christians go through all their life. They possess all of these rich blessings, but then they haven't possess them. And so there is a parallel with us with the book of Joshua. Now you'll notice on your notes here that I put people criticize the events of Joshua as ethnic cleansing. This idea of the fact that God told the Jewish people to exterminate the Canaanites. And of course, today, that is looked down upon by a lot of people in our culture. And there are some people that you try to talk about the Bible to, and they will come back with something about this. So I included this article from the ESV Study Bible that I thought was so good. I'll leave it all for you to read, but I do want to kind of summarize it. So turn to the next page, page 20, and there are 4 points here that I just think are so good. The first one, a fundamental Old Testament conviction is that Yahweh, the God of Israel, is the creator of all there is, and therefore the owner of all lands. He has the right to distribute territories according to his good and holy will. So you have to come from that fundamental point. God is the creator. God is sovereign. He has the right to distribute that land the way he pleases. Then the last sentence in that paragraph. This means that God has the ultimate rights over the land of Canaan, and that he has the right to bring the Canaanites to judgment for their moral condition and deeds. Because the Bible is very clear about that part as well, that the Canaanites were very, very immoral. And this was part of God's judgment on them. And in the book of Genesis, it talks about the fact that God got the Jewish people out of that land and left them for 400 years to their own sin. And instead of repenting and so on, they just got deeper and deeper and deeper. Number two, since all people are sinners, all are rightly subject to God's judgment. The Pentateuch gives a moral rationale for the removal of the Canaanites, seeing it as divine judgment for their iniquities. Then the next paragraph, God's judgment allows no double standard. Some people would say, yeah, but is that fair? The Jews just go skating by. Well, God's judgment allows no double standard. Go down to the next sentence. Unfaithfulness, referring to the Jewish people, will lead to judgment upon Israel itself. And so there is no double standard here. There is no, well, there's ethnic cleansing of the non-Jews, but the non-Jews are the Jews. Nothing happens to them. That is not true. Then number three, go down about halfway through that paragraph. After Deuteronomy 13:5 in parentheses, if Israel were to allow unrepentant Canaanites to remain in the land, they would drag the whole people down into idolatry, injustice, and evil. And God pointed that out over and over and over again as the reason why the Jewish people were to be separate from the Canaanites. Then do read that last sentence in that paragraph. Christians are not to carry out this kind of warfare because the people of God are no longer identified with a particular nation state. Then number four, about a third of the, well, let's see, first, second, third line, halfway across on the third line. The way Israel applied those laws apparently made room for some of the Canaanites to surrender and survive, particularly if they professed faith in the one true God. And you have two examples of that, Rahab, who we'll talk about, her life was spared, and then a whole group of people that we'll talk about, the Gibeonites. Then reading the last sentence there, this is another point showing that, strictly speaking, the command given to Israel is nothing like ethnic cleansing, since ethnicity itself is not the reason for the action. It's the sin, not the ethnicity. Then that last paragraph, these factors, God's right to allocate the land, judge the world with perfect justice, the need to protect the purity of the Israelite theocracy, and the provisions for even Canaanites to be saved. And here Rahab is even in the genealogy of Christ, the Messiah. All illustrate the justice that lies behind these provisions. At the same time, it is also clear that the practices known as genocide and ethnic cleansing are indeed evil, and the Israelites were not commanded to commit them. These factors were a unique part of Israel's mission. No people today have any right to use them as a warrant to support injustice. So I hope that article is something you'll read and kind of chew around in your mind. And if you're interested on the subject from a biblical point of view, there are a lot of other resources and a lot of other books. And you could even find a lot Googling Canaanites, Joshua, that kind of thing. Well, continuing on, then there is Christ in Joshua. As we've seen, Christ in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Christ is also in Joshua, and Jesus took the disciples on the road to Emmaus through the Old Testament from Genesis to Malachi, pointing out where he is in these books, and this would include Joshua. Although there are no direct messianic prophecies in the book, Joshua is a type of Christ. His name is Yeshua. In his role of triumphantly leading his people into their possessions, he foreshadows the one who will bring, quote, many sons to glory, unquote, Hebrews 2:10. So his name Yeshua, that's Joshua in Hebrew, is the name Jesus in Hebrew still today. And so among Jewish people, if you are witnessing and talking about Jesus, it will ring a bell to use the name Yeshua rather than Jesus, because it's the same name, only in exactly as it is in Hebrew, which is transliterated into English, Joshua. Then also, you'll see at the bottom of the page, the commander of the army of the Lord. He is a person that we're going to meet in chapter 5, verse 15. And the commander of the army of the Lord is, I think, that it's clear that he is a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. And when you compare Joshua 5:15 with Exodus 3:5, where in Exodus 3:5, God is telling Moses to take off his shoes because he's standing on holy ground. You have the same thing with this commander of Israel's army. So therefore, he's not some mortal human. He is God. And that would mean when God appears, he is the second person of the Trinity, the triune Godhead. So it would be an appearance of Christ before he was born at Bethlehem. So there is a reference to Christ in the book of Joshua. Then turning the page, there's another one, Rahab's scarlet cord. If you're not familiar with the story, well, that's jumping ahead, but Rahab is going to hide some Jewish spies, not the same spies of 40 years before, a new group of spies, who've been sent by Joshua to spy out Jericho. And she's going to hide them. And she happens to have an apartment that's on the wall, the outer wall of the city, the wall that's going to come tumbling down when Joshua and the Jewish army marches around it. And because of her faith, she and her family are going to be saved. The rest of the Jericho citizens are going to be killed. But she and her family are going to be saved. And the Jewish army will identify her apartment because she's going to put a scarlet cord out the window. And that's going to be the ID, and they're all going to be saved. Isn't it interesting that it's not blue, it's not black, it's not white, but it's scarlet. And there is this scarlet thread that goes through the Old Testament pointing to the blood of Christ. And this is one of those. And so there is a great implication of Christ here. And then, of course, this amazing woman later is found in the genealogy of Christ. She is, even though she is a Canaanite, she is a believer in the true God, and she is going to be brought into the Jewish family, is going to marry a Jewish man, and have a Jewish son who's going to have a Jewish son who's going to be the father of King David, and later be the family of the Messiah. Well, let's start going through the book, and the outline is in the ESV Study Bible. First of all, we have the first five chapters, crossing into the land. That is, crossing the Jordan River into the land of Israel. And we have A, Joshua's charge. That is, his words of exhortation to the Jewish people when they are on the verge of entering into the promised land. Let's read the first nine verses of the book of Joshua. Joshua 1:1. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, arise. Go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I am giving to them, to the people of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given to you, just as I promised to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, to the great sea toward the going down of the sun, shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forsake you. That is a very important promise. And it's a great promise that the Lord's going to be with them. He's going to go with them, not leave them, forsake them. And with God leading the way, no one is going to be able to stand up successfully in opposition to them. But when they don't trust in him, that will happen. And it's going to happen at a place called Ai that we'll get to in a minute. Verse 6, be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do according to all the law that Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. That is a good verse to memorize. If you've never spent much time with the verse, I would commend it to you. I mean, it has so much for us about being strong, about being careful to do everything that God has said, and then God's promise to give us success wherever we go. But do remember, this is not a carte blanche for necessarily getting a new car and a bigger house and better job. It's not always success in that way. It is success in God's way. Success in what God has for your life. Then verse 8. I like verse 8. Probably goes back to when I was 8, 9 years old, maybe. It's kind of hard to remember exactly how old I was. But my uncle, the same one who I asked prayer for a few weeks ago, he's now 80 and having very serious heart surgery. And by the way, he survived it and is home. And he says, man, he's been through the war. I mean, his chest is open and his arms and his legs because of the taking out for the bypasses. And then he had a new valve put in and all of that. But anyway, he was my hero when I was really young, in real ways. And when he came back from the Korean War, he brought back with him a packet, well, a box of memory verses, memory cards that were in a box. And he had been involved with the Navigator's topical memory system while he was in the military. And then he went beyond that, and he got this box of like 150 verses to memorize. And he had memorized them. And he gave them to me. I don't remember if I asked for them or that was just his idea. I don't remember that. But the one on the top that I first memorized was this verse. Now, don't ask me to say it today because I haven't reviewed it in years. But it was a verse then that became part of me because of memorizing it at such a young age. But this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. That is a verse to memorize and think about, meditate on, and apply in your heart. Then verse 9, have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened. And do not be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Great, great promise. So imagine, the Jewish people are on the banks of the Jordan River, about to cross over. What more significant could be said to them than that, to prepare them for entering into the promised land? So we have Joshua's charge in the whole first chapter. You got a little glimpse of it there. Then secondly, we have Joshua, the spies, and Rahab in chapter 2. So Joshua sends some spies into Jericho to come back with a report on, you know, what the defenses of the city are like and so on. Now they wind up in the apartment of Rahab. Now, there's a little problem for a lot of people with that because Rahab was a prostitute. And so some people have unfortunately looked at that and said, oh, guess what they were doing there. And that is absolutely contrary to what the whole flavor of the account in the Bible. The spies were not going there for immoral purposes. Rather, can you think of a place they could better be to be inconspicuous? Because there would be men going in and out of that apartment all the time. And probably men that weren't necessarily from Jericho, but from neighboring communities. And so it would have been a place where they could be inconspicuous. Now, she hid them. And when she hid them, she shared with them that she and the rest of the people in Jericho had followed the story and the account of God's taking them from Egypt to Canaan. They had heard about crossing the Red Sea. They had heard about the victories they had had over the Amalekites and so on. They had heard, evidently, about the water from the rock and so on. And Rahab was ready to believe in that God. And she did, as the spies were there. And so in Hebrews chapter 11, she is commended for her faith. Now, another problem to a lot of people with Rahab is that she lied. She lied to protect them, because when she was asked if those spies, after they left her place, when she was asked if she knew anything about the spies, she lied and she said no. So the question comes up, was Rahab justified in lying? And good Bible-believing Christians disagree on that. And you can read some good Bible teachers who will say, yes, she was under these circumstances. I personally don't. I think it's very clear in Scripture that lying is an abomination to God. And had she not lied, I'm not saying she had to tell everything that she knew, but had she not lied, I believe God would have somehow taken care of her and taken care of them. We don't know how he would have done it because it didn't happen that way. But I don't believe she did right in lying. And I would say the people I've read on it are probably divided 50-50 perhaps on saying that it was excusable for her to do and saying that it wasn't. But she is in the Hall of Fame of Faith, not for her lying, but for her faith, for her believing God and trusting him. Now turn to chapter 2, verses 8 to 21, and we'll just read what she said here. Chapter 2, verse 8. Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og." Remember when we saw them last week and I said you'll read about them over and over and over again in the Old Testament. And that happens here. "Whom you devoted to destruction. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt kindly with you, you also will deal kindly with my father's house, and give me a sure sign that you will save me, save alive my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death." And the men said to her, "Our life for yours, even to death. If you do not tell this business of ours, then when the Lord gives us the land, we will deal kindly and faithfully with you." And of course, I don't believe they should have asked her to lie. "Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was built into the city wall, so that she lived in the wall. And she said to them, 'Go into the hills,'" and so on. So here is a woman, a Canaanite woman, and yet her heart has been softened to the God of Israel as she heard the wondrous things that he had done. Well, back to the outline, then we have C, crossing the Jordan, chapters 3 and 4. That is a very dramatic moment when they finally cross the Jordan River. When you get to Israel, and I hope those of you who haven't been will get there someday, please brace yourself for being disappointed when you look at the Jordan River. Because the Jordan River today is not a raging river. And you look at that today and you say, that wasn't a miracle for Israel to cross that little thing. But today it has been the water, so much of the water has been diverted. More than 50% of the water is diverted for meeting the water needs of Israel. And some of it's diverted for meeting Jordan's water needs as well. So what comes out of the Sea of Galilee and goes down to the Dead Sea today is such a trickle compared to what it was. In the springtime, which this was, becomes obvious when these details are given. This is spring. They give the date, plus it's Passover, and so it's springtime. When it's springtime, before modern times, you needed a miracle to cross the Jordan River like they did, especially to cross it on dry land, just like they had done the Red Sea. But it was a very, very dramatic moment in Israel's history. Then in chapter 4, God commands them to, after they've crossed, to erect 12 stones as a monument, so that their children, when they come by this spot, and they're going to see those stones, they're going to ask, what are these stones for? and it provides an opportunity to tell them what God has done. That becomes a great pattern for God's people ever since. Families need to have traditions, for instance, and traditions that point out what God has done, and have pictures on the wall and mementos and things that remind us of what God has done. Beautiful moment in Israel's history. Then with D, the ritual renewal and the divine encounter. That's in chapter 5. When they got across the river, I'm sure they were anxious to get to Jericho and to conquer it and get started taking the land so that they can get the land divided among them and put down some roots and raise some crops and so on. But Joshua says, not yet. You're not ready. Because God instructed Joshua that the people needed to be spiritually prepared. During the 40 years in the wilderness, they had neglected the sign of the covenant of Abraham, which is circumcision. And they had not circumcised their baby boys. And that's the sign that these people are a separate people, are God's people. And so all the men had to undergo the circumcision. Now, obviously, I'm sure that, you know, that wasn't very pleasant for these adult men. It's a lot different to have it at 8 days of age. And medically speaking, the nerves aren't as developed then. It is not as painful and so on. But these men, all the Israeli men, went through it as an obedience to God so that they would be the separate people that God wanted them to be. I believe it's also God's provision that here they are so close to Jordan. So close to Jericho. They're on the other side of the Jordan, or they're on the Jericho side of Jordan. They're incapacitated. The Jericho army could have easily taken advantage of them, but God held them back. God took care of them. That's not the only provision that God said you've neglected. They had neglected the Passover. And so this is Passover season. So they're going to have another Passover ceremony, which will remind them of God's deliverance of them from Egypt and prepare them to enter into the promised land. But then they have this encounter with the commander of the army of the Lord for the purpose of reminding Joshua that his reliance is to be upon the Lord. Turn to chapter 5, verses 13 to 15. Joshua 5, verse 13. When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" Good question. And he said, "No, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, "What does my Lord say to this servant?" So Joshua recognizes he's in the presence of God. This is not a human commander. This is God. And since it's an appearance of God in the flesh, it's the second person of the triune Godhead, pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. Verse 15, "And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, 'Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy.' And Joshua did so." What a dramatic preparation for Joshua for the onslaught on Jericho. That brings us to the second part of the book, and that is taking the land, which is chapter 6 to 12. First of all, A, we have Jericho's fall, which is the first fruits of war. So Jericho is the first city. Jericho would have been the very first city that by far the majority of those Jewish people had ever seen in their life. because they didn't grow up in Egypt. They saw cities in Egypt, but they've been in the Sinai wilderness. There are no cities. There's communities, but no cities. Can you imagine looking at this massive wall and the ramparts and the towers and everything? And it would have been intimidating. But they have been encouraged by Joshua's instruction to them in chapter 1. Don't fear, but trust the Lord. And then God delivers the city in such a unique way, and I'm sure you all know the story. And we even have the song about it, Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho. And surrounding that city, going around it every day for 7 days. And can you imagine the Jericho citizens looking down and saying, what is this? And just mocking them and just taunting them. And then blowing the trumpets, and then all of a sudden, the walls fall. And the walls fell in such a way that they fell inward towards the city, that they were just able to climb over the rubble and get into the city. The ruins are still there. Jericho, by the way, is the oldest continuously inhabited city on the face of the earth. And there has been a Jericho there longer than any other city has been in existence. Now, it's moved around a little bit on its site. And today, there is no city directly on the ruins, but they're off to the side. And you can go today as a tourist and look into the excavation pit and see where they have excavated there. With Jericho, yes. And in fact, later on, God is going to put a curse on anyone that will rebuild the city of Jericho. Yeah. And so it was just left in ruins, and a new Jericho was built next door. And then that Jericho has fallen, the new Jericho, and so on. But yeah, yeah. And so it's an interesting place to visit. Today, Jericho, several years ago, Jericho was given by Israel. It used to be part of Israel, but it was given to the Palestinian Authority. After Yasser Arafat started the Palestinian Authority and as part of the negotiations for peace, Jericho, as well as Bethlehem, were given. And so today, very few Christian tourists go to Jericho because it's considered somewhat dangerous. And Jim and Sandy and Ray and Bonnie, you were on the trip, my last time to go to Jericho, the time we went up on the cable car up to the monastery. Oh, on your trip. Yeah. Okay, that was before. Then it was a trip after where they had built a cable car up to the Mount of Temptation, and we went on it, and they had just built it. It had only been open a few weeks. We were some of the first people to go up, and then the Intifada started. And everything collapsed, and tourists no longer went to Jericho. And I've not been back since. But anyway, a fascinating, fascinating place to go. But that's the conquering of Jericho. So it's called here the first fruits of war. It's the first city to be conquered. So therefore, God put a restriction on the conquering of Jericho. He said, don't take any loot. This is all to be strictly off limits to you. It's mine. And that's why a man named Achan gets into trouble, because he doesn't obey that. Now, no other city did God put that restriction on. But the very first one is the principle of first fruits, that the first fruits belongs to God. Then we have Israel in B, Israel's failure, Achan's sin, corporate guilt. What happened here? They've seen such a victory at Jericho. The next city is Ai, or some pronounce it I. It's the letters Ai. And they are defeated big time. And they ask God, why? And he said, there is sin in the camp. There was one of you who disobeyed me and took some loot from Jericho. And they wanted to know who he is, and God identified this man as Achan. And God gave them a lesson on total obedience. And Achan was killed, and his family were killed because of his disobedience. So in the outline here, Israel's failure, Achan's sin, corporate guilt. The idea of the corporate guilt is all of Israel suffered because of Achan's sin. Then C, Israel's renewal, Ai's defeat in chapter 8. Now that they have taken care of the sin in the camp, they go against Ai and God gives them the victory. Then also in chapter 8, is something comes about that we referred to, I think, 2 weeks ago. And that is the giving of the curses and the blessings at Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. There's a valley in Israel called Shechem, and Jacob's well is there. And on either side of the valley, there's a hill. Ebal is one, and Gerizim is the other. And in Deuteronomy, it was last week in Deuteronomy that we read about it. The God had said, when you get to the land, go here, go to these two hills, and half of you be over here and half be over there, and the curses are going to be recited against Israel. If you disobey me, here's the consequences. Here's what's going to happen. And then the blessings are going to be recited. If you obey me, here's the blessings. And Joshua obeyed, and Joshua did that. And the record of that is in chapter 8. Then D, Israel's Canaanite covenant, the Gibeonite ruse. This is a sad chapter in Israel's history. God has said, as we've seen, to exterminate the Canaanites. There was a family of Canaanites called the Gibeonites. And they were looking around and they said, how can we keep from being destroyed? Let's put on an act. Let's come to send some people to Israel, disguise them in costumes that look like they have been traveling for days, give them some dried out bread so that they can pretend like they're from a long ways off, that they're not local people. And have them come to the Israelites with this story, and then ask the Israelites to enter into an agreement to not destroy them and to kind of be allies together. And Joshua and the Israelites do that very thing. They fall for it. They didn't investigate. But what's worse, it specifically says in there, and the reference is chapter 9, verse 14, but they did not ask the Lord's counsel. And that is a great verse for us to remember, that we are to constantly be asking the Lord's counsel. And of course, today we get his counsel from his word. But we're to be seeking the Lord's counsel on our decisions. Don't be gullible and fall for everything. Well, then that brings to E, the defense of Gibeon, the conquest of the south, chapter 10. Well, Israel, now I would think, certainly in our culture, in our way of doing, Israel could say, well, this treaty was entered into under false pretenses. You lied. We're not obligated to keep it, but they didn't do things that way in those days. And Israel was obligated to keep that agreement. And so they wound up in a battle defending Gibeon. And it becomes the second most famous battle in the book of Joshua. The first is, of course, Jericho. This is the second. The reason that this is famous is that a miracle happens here. This is the day when the sun stood still. Ah, does that ring a bell? With Joshua, the day that the sun stood still. I wrote down here some of the details so I wouldn't forget it. So let me read it. Joshua had led his army in a march from Jericho to west of Jerusalem all night. So picture, the army's gone all night. They had trudged 12 to 18 miles in the dark, ascending more than 3,000 feet in a matter of hours. So they are exhausted. They fought a well-prepared coalition of forces from dawn of the next day until dusk. So they marched under hard circumstances all night, then they're fighting all day. They then pursued the stricken foes uphill, downhill, and uphill again. And then Joshua had the audacity to ask God for more time. Joshua says to God, God, if we had more time, we could defeat this enemy. And God answered that by, according to the book of Joshua, making the sun stand still. In other words, the earth did one rotation in 48 hours instead of 24. God, in doing that miracle, not only did the obvious, but stop and think about it. If the earth ever slowed like that, it would be cataclysm across this earth and the universe. But God stopped the cataclysm too. People have criticized this. First of all, those that criticize anything miraculous don't want to believe it. And then, of course, some people will criticize and say, well, we all know the sun doesn't move, the earth moves. And yet the same critic will talk in the morning about the sunrise. The Bible is using the language that we use to speak of the progression of what happens during the day. Another possibility, because the Bible doesn't explain how God did it. It's just that somehow or other, there was 48 hours with only one time of darkness. Another possibility of God doing this miracle would be that the sun moved in the same way to keep perfect pace with the battlefield. Either way, it's miraculous. And by the way, there are Egyptian and Chinese stories about a long day. I find that kind of interesting. So it's one of the miracles of Scripture. The God of creation can certainly do this. Has anyone heard about NASA discovering that there was, in their calculations, as they're trying to get everything very precise for the space shots and so on, and calculating where the planets and bodies of the Earth have been, they discovered a missing day. That is an urban legend. Yeah. I know, it's a great story. I have a great article about it in my files. It gives all the details. And I thought, as I was putting this together, I want to check this out a little more. So I Googled Joshua's long day. And I found reputable evidence that that is a legend. That has never come out of NASA. Yeah. So I'm disappointed because it is a great story. And then the story got even better because it said, but there was this other part that isn't explained by Joshua's long day. And then when you go and find out about King Hezekiah and when the sundial retracted, then that fit exactly what supposedly NASA had found was missing. But it's all baloney. So it is too bad. It's a good story. Okay, well, let's wrap it up. bottom of page 21, we have the conquest of the north and the list of the defeated kings. Turning the page to 22, we have the dividing of the land. Oh, I have to tell you, this section will either excite you or embalm you. On the surface, it appears like little more than a list of unknown towns, obscure families, and meaningless details. But put yourself in the position of these people who have finally entered into the promised land. Every one of these towns is important. Every one of these families is important. And they are important to God. Just kind of summarizing it, chapter 13 is A, it's yours, now take it, the idea about the land. Chapter 14 14 through 19 deals with the Western territories. A land of justice and worship, chapters 20 and 21. In this section, you have the Levites are given their 48 cities. They're not given a portion of land to be their tribe. They're not given a tribal area. They're given 48 cities scattered throughout. So they don't own a portion of land. They are to be totally devoted to the service of God and not involved in owning a big piece of property. But they're going to be taken care of by the blessings of God's people sharing with them. There is an application from that for people in ministry today, that the people in ministry are to be freed from having a secular job so that they can spend their time in the service of God and so on, just like the Levites were spared from having a secular piece of property, as it were. Then Roman numeral 4, serving the Lord in the land. We have one nation under God. We have Joshua's charge to Israel's leaders. That's chapter 23. That's rich, just like chapter 1, his charge at the beginning. And then C, we have the covenant renewal at Shechem and Joshua's last public act. He led them in renewing the covenant with God. And he says, as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. Well, that is an overview of Joshua. Next week, we go to the book of Judges. Very distressing book. But also, great things happen. But Judges. Okay, we'll turn off the recording. And